I fully understand that and appreciate it. But as you pointed out, there is a diminishing use of the repeater, and we can try our best to stimulate people to join a repeater and listen to the repeater by bringing up different topics. And what I'm suggesting is, if I'm not talking about CME for credit, I'm talking about CME for learning. We have MDs, we have PhDs, we have JDs, a lot of people involved either directly or tangentially in medicine, and I certainly am. So that's just what I'm saying. I can't get enough of it, to be honest with you.
Anyway, all of the questions.
Yes, what's your question?
Taking my call. This is Ray, K2CYR. Just a quick question. I just wanted to know that 10-meter net that you have in Brooklyn, what frequency is it and what time of day or week that you have that 10-meter net going on there, please?
Yes, Ray. It's every Sunday morning at 11 o'clock Eastern Time. It usually is on 28.380, but sometimes someone else is using the frequency, so we move 3 or 4 kilocycles to the right or to the left. Today we were at 28.384 because someone had decided to do a Parks on the Air activation on our usual frequency. So Sunday morning at 11 o'clock, okay?
Well, thank you very much for taking my call and give me that information, so I will definitely monitor Sunday if God spare my life. Thank you, Dr. Roy, for coming back to me.
Roy, I'd like to get a response from you.
Roy, is it Charlie? I got a question.
Okay, we got people tripling. Charlie, I got your write you down, and I'll get to you right next. Getting back to Stu. Again, I don't know what to tell you. I'm unfortunately not terribly optimistic about new nets because I'm kind of struggling to keep old nets from just kind of fading away from disuse. So I don't know what to tell you. I think primarily, as I think I mentioned it last week or something, you should kind of have a chat with Richie, the club president, because, you know, he's in charge of all these things. At this point in time, to my memory, there is the Monday night net, there is the computer net, and there's this net. There used to be a scanner net. It kind of faded away. There used to be an astronomy net. The guy quit, and it faded away. So, you know, it's not a good score for nets, but he would probably be the best person, get an idea. Some subjects have more liability issues than others, and go from there.
WA2DS, I understand what you're saying, but we're not trying to diagnose disease or treat disease. We're simply having an academic discussion. Would you, if I got some other clinicians interested, would you be interested as well?
I guess if there were enough people, and it depends on the frequency of it. I already am net control operator for 1, 2, 3 nets a week. And I don't know anyone else who does 2 nets a week.
That's a fair answer. I appreciate that, Roy. I just one thing, is Monday night the night for the computer net? Because I have to try to resolve a technical issue pertaining to my computer. I believe it's Monday. Would that be accurate?
No. The computer net is Thursday, I think. And I always get this wrong. I think it's the 3rd and 4th Thursday of each month.
Wednesday, Roy. WS2N.
No, like I said, I always get this wrong. Okay, it's the 3rd and 4th Wednesday of each month.
Okay, very well. Thank you. Thank you, Roy. And thank you to the other station. We'll just be listening and enjoying WA2ZFM.
Okay, Charlie, you're not actually the next person on the list. Joe was signed in before you. Is it okay if we do Joe first and then come back to you, Charlie?
No, I'm in a hurry. That's why I'm calling tonight.
Okay. What's your question, Charlie?
If you want to build up one, the net, you got to learn to get out to the public, and then you can start building your club. Number two, tell Paul that I won't see him. I won't be on the air with him tonight or next week. I got to run right now. All right. So I'll get back to you in about 2 weeks. Bye bye.
Okay, I'm sure Paul is listening because he just spoke a few seconds ago. And, well, the trick is always finding some way of letting the public know. You can't let all the public know. You know, I mean, you could put an ad in the Super Bowl. It costs you millions of dollars. And you get a very little return on assets that way. So, you know, in principle, yes, I agree with you. It's just how to work out how to maximize your contact of people who might be interested in this hobby as opposed to the random person on the street who doesn't even know what it is and doesn't particularly care one way or the other. But I hope you have a good trip, Charlie. Stay safe, be well, and we'll hear you back again in 2 weeks, I guess.
Thank you very much, and I'm sorry for interrupting like that.
Nah, it's okay, Charlie. Be well. Joe, are you still out?
Hold on. There we go. Roger, roger, roger. This is KC2QYW. So, I'm not sure if Roy's coming on later on today. Do you guys believe that since the universe or space never ends, I believe that there's other life out there. That's my belief. Do you guys believe that sometimes? Back to the net.
AC2GS. Okay. First point, Joe, this is Roy. So Roy won't be here later. Roy's been here for an hour and 10 minutes. This kind of goes back to conversations, the great conversations that I had with Dick, K2RIW. Whether the universe is finite or infinite, that's not a known thing. It might be finite. It might be infinite, but it might be infinite and bound like the surface of a sphere. Where does the surface of a sphere end? It just keeps on going. But it's bound. It's limited. People don't quite know. Astronomers feel that space-time is very close to being flat. There's an error, plus or minus, that might be a curvature. So they don't know. Do I think that there's life out there? Definitely. The universe is immensely big. We don't even know how big the real universe is. We can only judge what's called the observable universe. That's within our ability to see because light takes time to get to us. So there's only a subset of volume that we can look out at and call our universe. It has trillions of galaxies with trillions of star systems, and so the idea that it just happened here seems ridiculous. So I'm sure there's life all over the place. The problem is there intelligent life? Because there was not terribly intelligent life until about 600,000 years ago here. So, you know, if you went back to Earth 5 million years ago, you'd see monkeys at best. The problem is that we're all too far away from each other. So even if there is intelligent life that's technological, that has figured out how to make rocket ships, they're so far away it would take them an eternity to get here. So I don't think little green men land and probe people, but I do think that life is scattered amongst the stars.
Roger, roger, roger. I have my friend Lindsay in the car, and I think she has a question. Is he allowed to ask you a question?
sure she is.
Hi, Ray. My name is Lindsay. So I just read this recent article a couple weeks ago that says an 8-billion-year mystery. A powerful radio signal reaches Earth from deep space. And I guess a lot of scientists are baffled by this. They are describing it as a remarkable burst of radio waves has reached Earth after an incredible 8-billion-year journey through space, according to a report by Earth.com. Known as the FRB 2020-0610A, this burst is among the most distant and energetic radio signals ever detected. And a lot of scientists are thinking that this might be a sign of intelligent life coming from, you know, way in the past, because it takes so long for, you know, light waves to travel and whatever. But so I think that they actually might have found some sort of evidence of intelligent life from a distant galaxy. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Roger, roger. Back to the net.
Okay, that's a good question. Just because it's a very intense signal doesn't necessarily mean that it's an intelligent signal. If it's 8 million light years away, that means that it took 8 million years for that radio wave to reach us. There are a lot of natural causes for gamma rays and all manner of electromagnetic waves. So unless there's some embedded intelligence, like a string of prime numbers or something, it's very difficult to discern if it's a legitimate, intelligent emission, as opposed to, you know, there's all kinds of incredibly cataclysmic actions that go on in the universe. Neutron stars collide with each other, black holes collide with each other. Those produce immense discharges of energy and actually create heavy elements and such. So offhand, I don't recall whether there was any kind of significant intelligence noted in the transmission. It was just a very high-energy emission. There have in the past been these gamma bursts that have generated incredible amounts of energy in our direction, and, you know, everyone writes it down and tries to figure out what it is. I don't think I'm ready to say that some 8-billion-year-old civilization was able to kind of send us a signal that we can't decode. But, you know, you can believe.
Hello, Thomas. Roger. Yeah, right. So she just has one more question. Should we wait until next week Sunday to do that one more question? Or it's up to you. I don't want to hold the other guys and girls up on the net over here. Back to you, Roy.
AC2GS. No, it's okay, Joe. If she has a second one, I'll take a second one.
Hello. Okay, so my question is, what do you think about the Fermi paradox, which is the discrepancy between the lack of conclusive evidence of extraterrestrial life and the apparently high likelihood of its existence? I don't know if you've ever heard of the Fermi paradox, but it is from Italian physicist Enrico Fermi, who basically asked, like, when somebody asked him at lunch if there's extraterrestrial life out there, he asked in response, where is everybody? And so their conclusion to that was, if extraterrestrial life exists, it's because they want to kill you, and so that's why you're not hearing any signals from anyone. So what do you think about the Fermi paradox?
Okay. Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to kind of offend Fermi fans. He's a very smart guy. But again, I think it's a matter of the ridiculous isolation that every planet is fundamentally subject to. I mean, even if you keep to local solar systems, you know, it takes light, I think, 2 years to get to Alpha Centauri. Everything is just very far away from each other. So I think, unfortunately, there is so far, we estimate of the observable universe, a trillion galaxies, and each galaxy with a trillion suns, and maybe some of the suns have one planet that's livable, maybe two. So consider that humongous number. If maybe 0.0000001 of those percent, that's a lot of places that have life. But they're so far away from each other that it's kind of meaningless, ultimately. You can't get here from there because of time constraints. You know, if you had broken the faster-than-light-speed technology, maybe. But as long as you're stuck with the limitations of space-time, that you can't travel inside of it any faster than the speed of light, and usually much slower, it turns out to be kind of meaningless if there's life or there isn't life, because it's spread out thin.
A comment?
Sure. You know, another point I'd like to make is if you consider the average per cubic centimeter or cubic meter, the universe is empty, because most of it is just empty space. But please.
Oh, yeah, this is WA2VDH. Yeah, on the first question, that radio burst, it had a notation, FRB, which is, I believe, the notation they give to fast radio bursts, which are pretty much understood to be, due to colliding black holes or some other kind, similar to a gamma ray burst, except that it's at radio frequencies. So that FRB notation means fast radio burst, that usually has some high energy physics type of origin, right?
Okay, very good. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, the problem is that the SETI project and what have you are all kind of looking for some form of embedded intelligence. Like I mentioned earlier, like if there was a string of prime numbers represented in these signals, that would really get everyone's attention. But just to have a really, really powerful burst is interesting for scientific purposes, but no one's going to be looking for a visitation anytime soon. But thank you, John. I appreciate it. So, Joe, any response from your person in the car next to you?
Well, there's other people want to do questions, too. But, I'm sorry, Lindsay, you were saying something back in the 1970s?
Pan Pan, I'm not sure if Pan Pan's the right thing to say. So what about the WOW signal, narrowband, in 1977 that Ohio State University's Big Air Radio Telescope in the United States caught? What are your thoughts on that?
Roger, roger. Back to the net.
Okay. Well, I mean, it was certainly an interesting finding. There have been articles recently attempting to explain them as naturally occurring outbursts. I haven't really found anyone to kind of say yay or nay to it. My guess is that it's going to end up being a naturally occurring signal. But, you know, I mean, we're always kind of looking. So if you don't look, you're certainly not going to find. But I don't think the WOW signal it has stood up over time.
Okay, yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you, and love you all. And we will be back next week Sunday. And I'm not sure, did you guys change your times? Is it 8 o'clock on Sunday? Back to you, Roy.
Comment. One sec, and I'll let you comment. We didn't change your time. We started at 8 o'clock. We've been doing that for many, 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 many years. John, I think, you want to say something?
Yeah, good evening, Roy, everyone else on the Landmark TechNet. Probably a good segue. Well, one, if she's interested, or if anybody's interested, the John Krause books, Big Ear 1 and Big Ear 2, I believe, are the correct names for those books. Big Ear, I think, is what the name of the machine that received a wild signal, but if you read his books, he was head engineer, something like that, for whatever his title was for those projects. So check those out. I have both books. I have read them. It's been quite a few years now. But yeah, John Krause, Big Ear and Big Ear 2. Again, I believe those are the correct titles. Also, I was down at the VLA yesterday, so interesting segue if anybody wants to hear about that or cares, I don't know. It was a fun. We just drove down, did the open house tour they gave there, and came back, but we could always do that another time if anyone was interested.
Testing 1 2 3. Just want to make sure. I don't know. You I lost you, and then it looks. Okay, let's try that again. Okay, I'm back again. All-Star seems to be kvetchy. I don't know if it kicked you off, John. Again, you still seem to be on the website. I guess I should refresh it and see if you're still on the website.
Yeah, do you think it's something on your end? Or here I could reboot my router, try again. But if it's problematic, we'll... visited another time.
No, I think hopefully you're back. All-Star kind of hiccuped, and first it dropped me out. I think it then dropped you out, and now we're back together. So you can tell us.
Okay, yeah, the quick synopsis of what I said earlier. John Krause's books, Big Ear 1 and Big Ear 2, maybe it's just called Big Ear and Big Ear 2, great books about the system that received the WOW signal, or systems, and I was down at the VLA yesterday for their open house, so very cool, might be a good segue, or if anybody wants to hear about that, I don't know how well I can speak of it, but it was a very cool visit and very interesting.
Yeah, I'd love to hear about it. I assume that this is the same beloved John Krause who wrote those antenna textbooks that gave me a nosebleed.
The very same.
Okay, if you want to give us your own personal experience of your little trip, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, so the VLA, the Very Large Array, I know it's a very technical name, is an array of 27 radio astronomy dishes that are here in New Mexico, down not too far away from Socorro, about an hour west of Socorro in the flat highlands of New Mexico, a quiet, dark place. And I went down there for the open house. I've heard from so many of my friends and RF engineers and things up here that it's something I need to do someday. So a friend of mine and I made the trek yesterday. Very interesting. There are 28 dishes in total. There's always a spare back at the barn, they call it, I guess, getting repaired and ready to replace one that might have larger problems. And probably there's some kind of rotation there that they do regularly. But it was pretty neat. And got to hear a guy talk about the receiving equipment in each dish as well. It was a nice hour-long talk from him with PowerPoint slides and everything. You know, cryogenically cooled receivers to keep the thermal noise down and multiple bands. So there's all these different antennas and you know, LNAs all in kind of another array at each dish. So very cool and interesting.
Yeah, very good. It sounds interesting. I don't know if it's just coincidence. I've been reading a couple of science fiction books, and they're kind of using the same methodology, because I guess it's about traveling to another planet. It always has something to do with Arecibo or, in the three-body problem, a Chinese-built version of radio telescopes and such. So I don't know. I've come across a bunch of people reusing the same subject to get people to visit, usually Alpha Centauri, because that's usually in people's minds the easiest place to go off and discover, a new civilization and such. But it sounds like you had an interesting time. That's great. Thank you.
Question, WS2N.
Sure, Paul.
I understand those things were on tracks, is that true, where they could separate them either further apart, change the distance between them? I wonder if you saw anything like that. And is there any plan on adding more to the 28 arrays? Back to you, John.
Oh, yeah, excellent question. So I guess, for those who don't know, the reason for the array is that to build a single dish of greater size than places like Arecibo and other large aperture dishes, if that's the right term, they need to just put multiple dishes around and spread them out, because the physics of designing such a large dish would just be impossible, if not nearly impossible. So yes, they move them around, and one of the reasons is they're in a Y configuration, so there's 9 on each leg of the Y, and the reason to move them, and oh man, the machines that move them are really cool. They're these double train track machines. There's only 2 of them in existence. They're both there. It takes a whole team just to maintain the equipment to move these things around. And the reason to move them around is that as they're further apart, you get more resolution, and as they're closer together, you get stronger or brighter signals. I have some pictures. I can send those to you, but it's probably nothing that you can't see on any other site. And there's a video of them moving them on YouTube as well, which is really cool.
Thank you for that, John. Very good. They became famous with the movie Contact. That's where they first picked up the signal over at Socorro. Very good. Thank you for the info. Back to you, Roy.
AC2GS. Very good. Well, thank you, Paul. Thank you, John. It sounds interesting. Another thing I'm going to look up after that tonight.
Yeah, and one more thing before you go. Let me make sure I have it. Yeah, so they're also working on now the version 2. They're calling it NGVLA, Next Generation Very Large Array. So we got to see the structure, the first structure being built there. It's on site. You can see it. They're not more than just at the structure level at this point with the construction, although I'm sure the designs are much further along than that. So there will be a second generation if the funding all goes through. Obviously, they're building one to prove it out, and then if the funding goes through, they will build another 27 or 28 of them. I don't think they plan to populate every position, because I think the cost is just higher than actually moving and maintaining, the existing number. So I don't think, that was Paul's other question, that they will put more of them. It would be just a replacement of the existing fleet. And instead of a center I guess, I always get the terminology a little crazy because I'm not that much of a satellite guy. Instead of the hardware being in the center, which right now it's a double reflection. In other words, it comes into the dish, it bounces up to the aperture, I guess, and then bounces down to the antennas that are in the center of the dish instead of mounted up on the arms. The new design will be a side arm, and electronics will be there on the sidearm, so it'll only be a single bounce from the dish to the electronics, if that makes sense. I hope I said that clearly.
Yeah, it makes sense. It's good to know that they're innovating and they're building for the future. You know, every so often projects just kind of fall apart, like that great accelerator that was planned in Texas and just was given up on, unfortunately. It's nice to know when research funds are going for useful stuff. Every so often, research funds go into strange, odd places, kind of disproving unicorns and such. So fortunately, I hope they keep the budget low for things like that. But good to hear. Thanks.
KD2FYU.
Yes, George?
I want to make contact with the person who was talking about Krauss antenna designs.
Well, he wasn't really talking about antenna designs. He was talking about Big Ear and Big Ear 2. But that's John, KC2SHO.
John, KC2HSL. Do I have it correct? This is KD2FIU.
No, it's
SHO. SHO Kilo, Charlie 2, Sierra Hotel Oscar. Yeah, go ahead. I have probably the book that Roy is talking about, although there was so much heavy math in there. It's not one of the books I I regularly read to entertain myself.
I came across Krauss designs in building early beams, wire beams, and I wanted be able to contact you and share what I found about his designs with him.
Well, I always love more information, especially transmission line antenna theory and such, so I always welcome anything like that. I tend to have a large hoard of digital documents and links and such, so yeah, please do. I'm good on QRZ.
Excellent. KD2FIU, Foxtrot India Uniform, I'll contact you. Very heavy into Dr. Krauss's designs. It really, really helped me a lot. The concepts of phasing, outphasing, and spacing between elements really intrigued me.
Yeah, the subjects intrigue me as well. And one of these days, maybe when the kids are older, I want to start to build some of my own antennas instead of depending on the manufacturer so much. All right, well, good. Yeah, please send that to me, and I'll give it back to Roy. Appreciate that. Thank you. KC2GS from KC2SHO. Back to net.
Okay, very good. This is AC2GS. Well, George, send him the stuff, and you know, he'll hopefully he'll come back someday on the TechNet and discuss the subject. Long time no talk, George.
Thank you, Roy, for letting me in, and good evening. Thanks to John, KC2SHO. AC2GS, thank you.
Okie doke, very good. Let me just kind of check to see if Wes has come back into the room. Wes, are you out there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, I assumed you wanted to discuss those things you emailed me.
Yes, I am. So, increased observation before, Saucer 1 wasn't related to the Nobel Prize. Actually, kind of sidekick of the Nobel Prize. There was awarded 2024, but let me start from the beginning. So we have a Cybertruck. That was some time since the Cybertruck was on the list of the vehicles that are to be driven, or they are driven now. Let me try. There are pros and cons, and there are people who like it, people who hate it, whatsoever. So, Tesla Fan Account Group from Forum or Channel, mostly people deriding the vehicle itself or dunking on those who dare to say anything positive about it or negative. It depends for who you're dealing with. So the pros would be cyber swift acceleration, compatible ride quality, spacious interior, good electric range. So Tesla claims that dual motor all-wheel drive Cybertruck can cover up to 136 miles of range in just 15 minutes of supercharging, with Cyber Beast adding 128 miles in the same time. So 15 minutes, how much time it's taking us to fuel our vehicle. Let me drop. Okay, so we may take it any way we like it. Let's say we have 10 fools or 10 smart guys. It's up to you. But the rating is, the Cybertruck is rated 8.2 over 10. In critics area, the critics are rating 7.9 out of 10. So if we have a 10 smart guys, then we have a 7.9. Also guys who like the smart guys or the smart opinion. If we have a 10 fools, I'm not going to go into it. So we have a cons. And cons would be polarizing style, poor visibility, over-reliance on touch screens, mirror polish is dangerous to other drivers. Some of the owners attempt to make it mirror polish. Imagine that you have a mirror in front of you while you're driving. Unbelievable. Just unbelievable. Sharp edges, water testing by owner reviews electrical problems and makes vehicle disabled. So, number of videos and number of reports saying that the owners went to the water either on purpose or not, and the car couldn't move any longer. Okay, the competition would be 2025 because it's not 2024 yet. R1T, and this one is 69,000 to 89,000. The 2024 Ford F-150 Lightning is 54,000 to 84,000. Thus, the 2024 Chevrolet Silverado EV, this one is 94,500 firm. The GMT Hummer electric vehicle is 104,650, and the Tesla Cybertruck is $119,990, but you could buy a few dollars less. It is a 123 kilowatt hour battery that produces 600 horsepower, and it's 0 to 60 time drops to 2.6 seconds. So 2.6 seconds, you have a 60 mile. And we have another event that was last Thursday, 7 p.m. at Warner Bros. Discovery Movie Studio, Burbank, California. So before I go to it, imagine that you have a vintage white enamel toaster with two chrome stripes extending from the rear over the top to the front. So there were 60s, 50s toasters. Some of the, us could remember that. Older guys are not that old, but I remember those toasters. So it is not a toaster. It's a robo van for 20-person autonomous transport that was introduced by Elon Musk. And its inspiration comes from the Mercury Streamliner train from 1936. But the good thing is that 20 people, if they share that van, the cost per mile is 5 cents to 10 cents per mile. Now, another product that was last Thursday at 7 p.m. presented by Elon Musk was CyberTaxi. Now, interesting is that CyberTaxi or CyberCab has no pedals, no steering wheel. It costs under $30,000. The version that I saw was two-person, Dr. Roy, correct me if I'm wrong, autonomous car. That car drives you to work, and it looks by itself for the parking spot, or by itself park at the parking lot. interesting is that you're going from Long Island, you're going to New York, you're going to work, and your car could be searching for the parking for the whole day, and at the same time nobody can give you the ticket because it is in movement. It is looking for the parking spot. Thank you, Joe. Okay. We have another guy, Fisker bankruptcy. So we had another vehicle. I'm not sure if everybody heard about it, but there is a Fisker company. It was Dutch billionaire who wanted to make a vehicle. The vehicle was absolutely beautiful. And he filed for the bankruptcy in June. The Ocean EV maker agreed for $46.25 million of American dollars of deal with the court. The deal is the liquidation of new previously owned and damaged units through the sale. So it looks like they made the vehicle, but the vehicle wasn't up to the standard or wasn't satisfying the client. I'm not sure about it, but it was October 15, 2020 that he announced that he's gonna be making the electrical vehicles, and now we have a 2024. If somebody has more information, I would appreciate that. So that's what we have about the vehicle part of it. Anybody has a comment or story, please?
AC2GS. Yeah, I mean, look, Elon should be paying you. You made a whole bunch of claims that were not really proven.
That's done.
I don't think it showed it parking any place. It just kind of stopped and let people off, and people got on it, and it went on a pre-planned a map that they've had about a month to tweak. And there's a whole bunch of other problems. I doubt that the CyberCab is going to cost $30,000. It's probably going to cost a lot more. There's a whole bunch of problems with the cab. How do you insure a cab? You know, if you insure a car that's your personal car and you're driving the car, that's one thing. Although I understand that some people are having some problems with the Cybertruck getting insurance and keeping insurance. If you start to lend that out to strangers, could you imagine what your insurance bill would be? And, you know, people who have driven taxis and such are well aware that there's a degree of maintenance that a RoboVac is not going to solve. Someone gets sick in your cyber cab, and you're going to have to clean it. So, and there's hundreds of other little things. The the Optimus robot was nonsense. It was basically just remotely operated, obviously, because there were guys talking through the speaker with local accents that the voice synthesizers usually don't have. So it was such a fiasco that the stock price went down 9% the following morning.
Yes, I agree. Actually, 7%, I've heard, but maybe it went to 9%. Imagine that he makes an introduction of the new, by his word, promising product, and then his stocks drop down. Interesting. Anyhow, any other comments? DJI drone. So we have a drone, and many of us bought the purchase of two drones. You can purchase them in a B&H or any other places, and could be for any reason, some for amateur photography, aerial video, or some of us just for pleasure, and some of us for work. Now, in June 2024, CCP Drones Act was incorporated by the House of Representatives into the draft of National Defense Authorization DNA, NDAA for 2025. So in other words is, we have a bunch of drones used for military purposes in Ukraine and plenty of other things, and from something that was entertaining us or used for the job, now we didn't in the situation where national defense is interested, we're banning it. In July 2024, the Countering CCP Drones Act was clearly missing from the Senate version of 2025 NDAA when it was issued, but late in July 2024, a proposal to include Countering CCP Drone Act was made by Senator Rick Scott, Republican from Florida, in and amended the Senate version of 2025 NDAA. So the problem that they have is dangers of espionage, according to intelligence reports. DJI, Chinese company that is major one in United States, and it's standard right now, could use it, or somebody could use it to spy on U.S. individuals and businesses. And to XGN. Defying Chinese influence, the prohibition is viewed as means of preserving American sovereignty while fending off China's expanding influence. So there are many informations. Also, the action of the FCC is listed here. Drone ban bill passes House and is headed to the Senate. That was in September 11, 2024. And I'm not sure if the Senate worked on it yet or made the decision, but because after that it goes only to the president to sign up. So, Dr. Roy, back to you.
Okay. Anything in particular you want me to do with that?
Well, the thing is that based on the information that I have, anybody who owns the drone right now and has a license to use it could use it. But for starting from that point, no new licenses will be issued, so you cannot fly the new drones. So my question to you is, were you able to find something more about Senate action on it and what's going to be happening? Back to you.
No, I haven't. I don't know if this is passed yet. I mean, the problem with legislation is it can take a long, long time. It starts in committee, goes out of committee. It has to be the same law as that the Congress wrote up, then it goes to the president. The president has to sign it. I would imagine that I would have read about it if the president had signed it into law. So I'm kind of wondering if it's still in committee someplace, getting continuously worked on. It is a problem. Government officers can't use Chinese cell phones, which I think is a good thing. Whether drones are that kind of dangerous to have around, I don't know. Equally dangerous is we all have cheap Chinese webcams, and I'm sure they're capable of checking out every single camera we put up manufactured in mainland China. So, we're already a kind of security risk as it is. Whether clamping down on drones is going to make us that much safer, I'm not quite sure. But I could see the rationale for it personally. But there's only so much you can clamp down unless you're willing to start up a drone business of high-quality drones in the United States or some favored nation. Right now, probably the best drone in the market is DJI. I don't think too many people would argue that, and so it leaves a problem. Whereas cell phones, Chinese cell phones, you can take them or you can leave them. There's nothing special about them. So, I'm not quite sure about DJI.
Interesting. The DJI drone ban is a complex issue with strong arguments on both sides. Starting from the Clinton time, 1998, when NAFTA was created, it was a Trojan horse to open up the market for China. And it looks like for many, but not for all, that you are giving chance for the TF to steal, because one of the requirements for American companies to be in China is to give up their secrets and their technology to China. So that was not a good move. 90,000 of businesses were moved to China, American businesses. Okay. Any comment, if there is, and I go to the last one.
Hey, C2GS, a lot of companies are leaving China. They're just getting up and walking away because of those reasons, because their business regulations are disgusting. They basically favor their own countrymen, and they do steal their intellectual property. So a lot of companies that did go to China are now leaving. They're going to the Philippines. They're going to Taiwan. They're going to Thailand. There's a whole bunch of Vietnam. There's a whole bunch of other places. They're going to India. So unfortunately for the Chinese, their economy is in the crapper, if you will. Just recently, they had a bit of activity in the stock market, and a whole bunch of people invested and lost their life savings. The real estate market collapsed. Banks are failing. It's a controlled economy, so it's never going to go bankrupt because it'll just print out more yuan. But they're in a mess right now.
Okay, the next one into FGN. The next one is microRNA. Victor Ambrose and Gary Rufkin were awarded the Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine on Monday for the discovery of microRNA. A tiny class of RNA molecules play a crucial role in determining how organisms mature and function and how they sometimes malfunction. And we could skip it if it's not that we are animals. You like it, you don't like it. This is official science. I'm animal, you are animals. We belong to the group of mammals. science. That's Darwin. And that discovery includes humans. So it's the development of health and multicellular organisms, including humans, that is the mechanism that was revealed by two scientists, Dr. Roy.
Yeah, I think pretty much everyone, I hope everyone here will admit that we're in the animal kingdom.
If you would like to say a few words about microRNA, Dr. Roy.
Okay. Well, you know, we had that human genome project back in the turn of the century, and we were able to decode the genetic sequence for a bunch of different protein synthesis, because primarily our understanding is that DNA unfurls, RNA produces a complementary pair, and then the messenger RNA is then packed off to ribosomes, which is a protein assembly factory, and depending upon the triplet code, it assembles a protein. And then there was the question of, well, why is there so much DNA that doesn't seem to do anything? To which the concept of junk DNA was proposed. And also there was some talk about methylating groups, kind of activating or deactivating genes, or proteins wrapping themselves around portions of DNA that protected it from being replicated as a means of controlling reproduction of protein. But science goes on. They discovered that there's short patches of seemingly nonsense DNA that codes for seemingly nonsense RNA, but it seems to be attacked by an enzyme that then splits it into about 20 or 30 sequences apiece, and they call that microRNA. And the microRNA has a place to work its magic. It has regulatory controls on activating and deactivating the translation of genetic sequences, whether they're translated to proteins or not. So microRNA is an example of non-coding DNA being used to produce something that is self-regulatory. So this is some portion of your DNA is being controlled by the placement and removal of microRNA particles on your genome. That's the short run. It's a lot longer, but there's a lot of non-coding DNA that has been found to do all kinds of interesting things. But this particular Nobel Prize was for the discovery of microRNA.
Okay, I have a question for you, Dr. Roy. I have four cats. So three are feral, one is mine. And I feed them, and I've noticed that those cats, when they finish eating or they don't want to eat, they try to bury that food in something. And it looks funny when you have a wooden floor in a house and the cat is trying to bury the food that is there. If, let's say, the cat doesn't want to eat it, he does it too. My question is, how that information is implemented in genes that a cat does it? They don't know that they even do it. They just do it. Back to you.
Well, I mean, neurophysiology is an incredibly difficult subject, and medical science knows very little of it. The genetics seemingly codes for the creation of different lines of